history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who have extraordinary stories to tell, even if they seem like ordinary people. Once we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to their stories, we're amazed. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman you're going to meet today is 96 years old, a lifelong resident of the San Francisco Bay Area, except for his time in the U.S. Army during World War II. He's a little hard of hearing because of all the artillery he had to listen to over in Europe during World War II, so I might shout a little bit. Al Bertoli joins us now. Al, you grew up here in San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
So what was San Francisco like before the Golden Gate Bridge? You were here before that.
It was a great place to live. I remember all us kids. It's not like today. We played kick the can, one foot off the gutter, heats and hockey, all those games. We really enjoyed ourselves. We used to take and eat apricots, take the shell, rub it on the sidewalk, and make a whistle out of it. That's the entertainment we had. It was a great life. All the doors were open. There was no gates or anything like that. Everybody knew everybody. In my neighborhood, there was about 30 of us that really run around together. And right today, myself and Nancy D'Amico are the only ones left. Great bunch of people, I tell you. I watched them build the Golden Gate Bridge. I was 17 years old, and it was a great celebration. It really was. To see that bridge and all those people, when it opened, it swayed so much, they thought it was going to come apart. I mean, there was too many people on it. It was full. We traveled over that bridge. It was 25 cents. Then it went to 50 cents. Now I believe it's over $6. I don't go over it no more. But anyhow, it is a great city. And one day I went back. I had my grandmother, my grandfather. They taught me to talk Italian. I talked so much Italian, I didn't know much English. When they passed away, that's when I started to go to school and start to speak English. But I went back one day to Balboa Cafe, which is on Fillmore and Greenwich, and up the street is the firehouse, and then two houses from that was my grandfather's and grandmother's. They had two garages. They had a long stairway going up, a long alleyway going up to the back steps. He had a garden. He had rabbits. He had goats, and he was a produce man. He had a horse and wagon, used to sell produce. In them days, then the fish man went out on Friday, and then the rags and bottles sack man, he was running around picking up stuff. But, you know, those were so great. And then what we loved was when the harvest come in for grapes, and all the Italians, you know, they all got maybe a ton of grapes or half a ton, whatever it was. And they would make their wine. Well, when the trucks were looking down the street, all us kids would run and holler, Fuji. So the kids would come out, we'd grab a bunch of grapes and throw them to each other, you know. It was a lot of fun. But I'll tell you what, today will never match what I had and what I have seen. Believe me, I miss all my friends, miss my family. But anyhow, I went back there to see my grandfather's house. And I looked there and it's all shingled in front and everything. I couldn't believe it. So I rang the bell. Lady answers and I says, I'm sorry. I says, I hope I didn't bother you, you know. And I says, my grandfather and grandmother used to own this property. They said, no, there's 5 units here now. She says, I'm one of the units. See, my grandfather had 2 garages on each side, one on each side. Then he had the barn in the back. Then he had the goats in his special pen. He had the rabbits under the house, under the back stairs, rather. Then he had his garden up the backyard. And that's the way we ate, You know, I mean, we went to the store. I went to this butcher shop, and for 25 cents, you get top round New York steak or whatever you want, you know. But today, you buy a New York steak, it's $16, $19 a pound. I can't believe it.
Well, and you would know because you spent most of your life as a butcher. But when did that start? How old were you when you first got going in that meat business?
13. I was scraping blocks. And then days we had sawdust on the floor. You're going to like this one. And if you dropped something on the floor, it would get full of sawdust. We would take a beef tongue and rub it down that piece of meat. And that beef tongue, the way the whatever it had on its tongue, would take that sawdust right off. We'd take and fix it up nice and put it back in the counter. But that's the way it was in those days. And then I used to scrape the blocks. I learned from a left-hand butcher, Ansonino Lynch was his name. He'd bring calves in, and we'd have to skin them. So he was trying to teach me how to skin. He's left-handed, right? I'm right-handed. Boy, did we get into some arguments. He says, Alberto, you're not going to learn. You're not going to learn. Well, I skinned a lot of calves when I got older, I'll tell you. But anyhow, I scraped blocks there for him and another butcher shop on Buchanan between Filbert and Greenwich. Frank Squataguazza was his name. And I scraped his blocks, cleaned the glass, and changed the sawdust, everything else that he had to do, the bathrooms and everything. And I used to make, about 75 cents a week from him and 75 cents a week from the other. So I had $1.50. That was a lot of money. So what I did, I used to go out to the Presidio of San Francisco, and I go to where they make the bread. And we could buy bread for 1 cent. So I buy 2 or 3 loaves of bread for 3 cents. I bring them home. We'd have butter, bread, and peanut butter, or just sop bread into gravy and have like that. We'd clean the plates, and a lot of spaghetti and macaroni. That's the way we lived. And then, you know, the old-timers, they did a lot of cooking. Today, the people can't do the cooking because they both have to work to make ends meet.
What was the best Italian specialty your mother used to make?
My mother, minestrone. Boy, I'll tell you. And, you know, I don't know if people ever heard of it, but I had an uncle, Gene Della Maggiore, and my aunt used to make minestrone for him about 3 times a week, because the other 2 days or 4 days, he used to put farina in there, which is cornmeal. It thickened it, and he'd eat it that way for 2 or 3 more days. But, you know, it was easy to live then. I mean, gas was 10 cents a gallon. The Balboa Cafe, I remember on Sundays, they had family lunches. And the family lunches consist of a salad, soup with bread, and then they have all a bunch of cold cuts. They fixed chicken. And I keep trying to find out how from somebody. They don't know how. But they fix it in such a way that it was so delicious. They did it in a frying pan. And you know how much that costs? 75 cents. With your dessert, too. Uh-huh. 75 cents. Yeah. My father had the restaurant. He charged 75 cents for dinners.
I'm sure you have a ton of stories from San Francisco back then, but I'm curious about what you remember about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard what happened?
In Hillsborough, California, with my friend Walter Davini and his brother Ernie, and we were at his grandfather's ranch. His name was Torquio. Walter was in the house, and he heard that the United States declared war on Japan. And we all looked at each other, went down. Ernie went in the Navy, Walter went in the Army. I was supposed to go with the Coast Guard because I had a dentist out in Geary Street that knew somebody down there, but I didn't go and see him, and I went and joined the Army. But that was a hard feeling because all of us, most of the guys, they all went to the Navy, and they were in Guam or someplace in there. Some of them met each other over there, you know. But I was out in the bulge in Germany. I had this fellow with me. His name was Geisinger. He was in the Arctic Circle for a long time. I think it was 3 years. So he come and he was in our division, and I happened to be his partner. So we dug holes together and everything, you know. When we dug holes in that shale, you'd use gloves because the shovel, it's loosened it, but you'd have to use these, your hands to take out all the rocks, all the shale. So we built a pretty good hole, and him and I went down into town and got a door off a house. And we packed that up at the cell in the bulge, and we had a good view of everything. In fact, I was on the right flank. Tarpley was in the front. Carney and Bartosik, they were in the left flank. Geisinger and I were in the middle, and we got this hole dug, put the door over it, put all the shale back on top of it. So Geisinger had good hearing. He said, hey, hit it. Hit the ground. That's what for. He said, hit the ground. And he could hear this. The 88. And boy, when it hit, it hit it. So Topley says, hey, you guys come up here into this foxhole. He says, stuff is coming in pretty heavy. I looked at Geisinger. He looked at me. Pretty sure here comes another 88. He goes, we both got in and hit that foxhole. We went in where we dug. Not where he wanted us to go. It was real close.
So the guy told you to jump in a hole that actually got hit. Good thing you didn't listen to him, huh?
Yep.
I want to come back to that, but I want to take you to before that. Because when you first got into the Army, you were an MP in California. People have heard a lot on this program about the Japanese internment, the Japanese Americans on the West Coast sent to the camps. You were at the Manzanar internment camp as military police, a guard. Was that strange for you? Because I'm sure you knew some Japanese people growing up, right?
Oh, I met a lot of Japanese people in San Francisco when I grew up. I had two real good friends, Buster and Frank. They come into my house all the time, sat down, had lunch or something with us and everything. I'll tell you, the Japanese people that I knew, I went to school with and everything, they were great people. I mean, there was, sure, the United States, they're not going to take any chances, so they round up all the Japs and put them into a camp, which I don't think was right myself. I mean, they could have went in and figured out who was what and what was who, but they didn't do that. And it was a shame because the way those people had to live in those camps, and then they had to go out and make gardens of vegetables and watermelons and what have you, so they'd have stuff to eat. It was a bad situation.
Well, that must have been hard for you then to be a guard there and to see them basically as prisoners, and you're one of the guys that makes sure they're not taken off somewhere or doing anything. Was that difficult for you?
You know, you're in a big tower, and you're running a searchlight. That's as far as it got with me. And then we had to dig pits so we could get into and have our machine guns there in case something come up. We could have it all around the center, you know. Those poor people, there's little kids and everything. You know, today, there's still some of those people living, the younger generation. They're great people. I take my hat off to them for what they did and what they accomplished after they were released from these camps.
And when you say you had to dig those pits, you guys were preparing for the possibility that they would try to stage a revolt.
Yeah, we thought they were going to escape. We did. When you took them out and into the fields, you had to watch because if they decided to run, you know, you either have to tell them to halt or shoot them, one or the other. And once they get loose, they're not going to stop. I wouldn't stop. I'd keep going if it was me.
I bet you're glad you never had to do anything like that, huh?
No, never. Thank God.
But you did get yourself into some trouble there. They said you stole some watermelons?
Well, they grew a lot of watermelons. One machine gun pit was all full of watermelon husks. And I got blamed for it, okay? Because I was out there stealing one watermelon, and they declared that I did them all. So that's when I went on duty.
And what was that duty?
That duty was to take and dig holes for gas tanks to take out of the ground, a grease pit. Go in the morning, they get a truck, load it up with rocks, put it all around this perimeter. Then I painted it white, and I printed on the highway, I printed chicken. Anyhow, the rest of it you could hear.
So you're supposed to paint the rocks, but you paint this message to your superiors on Highway 395. How did they react to that? Did they think it was a big joke and laugh it off?
How did they react to that? They didn't like it, man. They decided what they were going to do with me, especially Captain Nails, because Lieutenant Hass and Lieutenant Singer, they liked me, and they were ready to give me promotion and everything. They told me, Al, this is what you got to do, you know. So after I did that job, they told me to fill all the stoves in the barracks with oil. So I did a wonderful job there till I got to the CP. When I got to the CP, I was pouring oil in the stove, and Lieutenant Hass was talking to Captain Nails, telling him that he would like to give me a promotion. And when Captain Nails said that, I thought the whole camp outside heard it. He said, no way, no way, that man is going to get a promotion. Then that's when I told him I wanted to go, wanted to transfer. I was reading the Times, and they said they needed people in the front line. Well, the people in the back line were doing a good job, too, believe me. And that's what edged me to go.
So because you knew you weren't going to get a promotion there, you just said, even though this is going to put my life in jeopardy, I want to go overseas. Were you nuts or what?
I didn't think so at first. But when I got in the front line, I told myself, what an idiot you are.
Well, and we're going to find out what exactly made him feel that way when we come back. 96-year-old Alberto Bertolli of Belmont, California is our guest today. If you want to see what he looks like, pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.